This is the Wednesday, July 24th, 2013 edition of Smart People, a half-hour show featuring interviews with, well, smart people. The show was started this spring by Sarah Buchanan. I am your host, Elmer Weens. Today I am talking with a smart and talented author, my friend Mary Rizal. Mary's new book, Dreaming of Horses, will be released in the near future. Welcome, Mary. I am very pleased that you agreed to this interview. How are you today?
Well, I'm very glad to see you again, Elmer. It's always nice to talk to you about writing.
Yes, Mary, we got to know each other when you were taking a creative writing course at UBC last year. I was taking the same course.
And we were very good students.
Yes, we were. We were excellent students. You're coming up with this new book called Dreaming of Horses. You were trained and worked as a nurse. Tell us how your working background influenced you as an author of young adult and adult fiction.
Well, one thing about being a nurse is that you see the human drama. You see the very happy couples with their firstborn baby. You see elderly patients dying and grieving families. And people are at their very best and their very worst. Very dramatic. It's quite a bit like the military, so that there are mistakes being made, there are punishments being dealt out, there are cover-ups. It's really a very intimate look at real life.
Your book, Runaway at Sea, tells the story of a 16-year-old girl, Annie, who takes a job on an ocean liner, possibly plagued by typhoid, from San Francisco to Vancouver. She seemed motivated by family issues, and you and I have talked a bit about issues in families. Is the response by Annie in your book typical for 16-year-old girls, or is this more like a fantasy someone in those circumstances would have?
Well, it's certainly a fantasy of mine to run away to sea. I would like to do it right now. But I think that these are common problems for all teenagers as they rebel against their parents. They might not always get the opportunity that she took, but I think that the problems with adolescents are timeless. They are trying to develop their own autonomy. They are rebelling against teachers, parents, and all authority, and they're trying to find out exactly who they are.
Yes, this issue of identity is really important at that age. I guess they want to know who they are and what they're going to be doing. And sort of set a pattern for teenagers might do in those circumstances.
Well, what I see is that teenagers are always trying out different roles. They look around at adults or perhaps someone they admire, a contemporary that they admire, and they try that role on for a while to see if it fits them. Eventually, they develop their own sense of themselves, although it takes quite a while.
In this particular book, I think Annie was like 16 years old, and she encounters an old friend in San Francisco who is somewhat older than she, and she has this fantasy of going to Vancouver with him, but he doesn't seem to want to do it.
Unfortunately, once I've written a book, I forget about it completely, so what you're telling me now is all sort of new and interesting, and I don't remember it at all. What I do remember is that the main reason that I wrote the book was that this is based on a true incident in Vancouver in the 60s when one of the P&O liners came in flying a double yellow flag indicating that there was quarantine. And in fact, there were several cases of typhoid on board. So that was what really fascinated me, and I kept all the newspaper clippings at that time, and it was later on, you know, 20, 30 years later that I developed it into the book. But that was my interest, not really Annie. She just was the protagonist. I chose to work out that plot.
The Vancouver Public Library search engine lists 6 books that you have published. The UBC library has several more books. Is there a theme that runs through your books?
Well, there certainly is a theme in my YA books. I do have a science picture book on DNA for kindergarten to grade 7, and that does not have a theme other than the mystery, the code of DNA. And I have a local history of the St. Mary's Catholic Church on the Sunshine Coast. But to get back to the YA books,
the YA books, those are the young adult books.
Yes. They are always based on something that really bothered me when I was a teenager, something that puzzled me that I tried to work out, never found an answer that satisfied me until I began to write. And I found by developing characters with the problems that I had that actually I began to see what the essence of the problem was and how it could be solved. So I have to have a passion about what I'm writing, and it's usually a passion about what has bothered me and what sense can I make of it looking back.
So you said these themes are somewhat autobiographical, and the stories themselves, how important are they to the book? I know a person who wants a story, wants a plot. A young adult perhaps wants a different type of story than an adult would have. So how important are the stories themselves along with your themes?
Well, YA books are very carefully crafted. You have to, for example, in the first chapter, have your protagonist, the sex, the age, a hint of the conflict to come, and that character has to be developed so that she, by the end of the book, has learned something, has probably changed in some basic way. What was the question again?
Well, the theme in the story, you seem to create characters that are very like Annie, I thought was would have been a likable person. That's the character from the book that we were talking about, Runaway at Sea. Do you purposefully create someone who's likable?
Well, one of the things I learned early on was that you have to have your protagonist have some faults to make them likable so that your reader can identify with them. But the faults have to be minor. Like, that is, you can't lie and you can't steal, but you can become angry, you can be outspoken, you can be impulsive. So those are good faults, but the other ones you can't be. People don't like them.
And like we learned in our creative writing classes, you and I were taking together, once you have a protagonist, you have to have someone operating against them, and you have to have bad things happening to your protagonist. Otherwise, it's not an interesting story.
That's true, and usually the bad people are the parents, the teachers, authority. Although in one of my books, Smuggler's Moon, I have a friend be the bad character, a manipulative person, actually based on a friend I had in school, and I couldn't figure out why I had gone along with it, because I could see quite clearly at the time that I was being used, manipulated, and I thought that I must be very weak to have allowed it.
Is that the peer pressure that young
No,
adults?
She was just a very good manipulator. If you've ever read the book What Makes Sammy Run, I think it's Bud Schulenberger, it's published in the 40s, there are people who can get other people to do what they want. They're just very clever. I was very relieved when I finished the book and had spoken to other people about this problem to find out that most people had this problem themselves in their life in the teenage, that there would be a very strong person who would take over, and they ended up doing things they didn't really want to do. A very good example would be smoking, and that again is peer pressure. They don't really want to smoke, but someone sort of calls them on it and they do it just to fit in.
And it's usually some individual who initiates that.
Well, this particular girl was very, very adept, and everybody in that class, and it was actually it was the whole high school, and there were only about 9 people in the whole high school, all thought that she was their best friend. She was good.
Mm. We'll be talking a bit more about Smuggler's Moon.
This is Elmer Weens hosting Smart People, a 1.5-hour show featuring interviews of smart people, started this spring by Sarah Buchanan, right here at CITR 101.9 FM Radio, Vancouver. Today, I have the pleasure to be talking to author Mary Rozell.
Mary, your young adult novels, Snow Apples, Salmonberry Wine, and Night Fires, all concern a character named Sheila Brary, who grows up in a small coastal BC village, much like you did. Are these books the most autobiographical of your books?
Well, I think that all of my writing comes from what I've experienced. I'm going to answer your question quite directly about snow apples because it's a question that everybody asks me, and I actually have got a lot of flack about it during the years. I have never had an abortion. An abortion is featured in snow apples. However, I've worked with abortion patients, and I have a great deal of compassion for the decision that they've had to make. Even in 1948, when I first went in nurses training, we would have women come in who'd had illegal abortions, and although we had penicillin by that time, it was developed during the Second World War, they were dying. So I have never had an abortion, so that book is not based on my personal experiences. Certainly, I grew up in a similar locale up the coast, and certainly the family are similar to my family. I have four brothers, but I would like to think that almost every writer draws from their own lives for experiences to write about.
One reviewer of Salmon Berry Wine said, "Salmon Berry Wine is highly recommended for young adult readers from age 15 up. It promises the moral value of responsibility to a cause, the question of medical ethics, and, of course, the romantic interest with a young intern, which helps to carry the story along." What's your response to that kind of a review?
Well, it's a very nice review. It's always nice to have a review, good or bad. It helps to sell books, as my late husband Eric Nickel used to say. I wrote that book almost as a compensation for snow apples because, as I mentioned, I got so much flack for snow apples. It was very controversial. People were critical of it for its subject matter. So I wanted to write a book about a nurse who helped to save a baby, an unborn child. And, of course, I drew on my experience as a student nurse at St. Paul's Hospital in 1948 to 51. And I had a composite of two patients for the one patient in that novel and put them together as one person and also condensed the time frame. You don't have that many interesting things happen in 1 year. You might spread it over your 3 years of training, but just for readability, I put it all into 1 year.
Very interesting. Your book, Smuggler's Moon and Haida Quest, are also set along British Columbia's coast, although during different time periods. I was intrigued how alcohol was smuggled into the USA during their prohibition days. During your research for Smuggler's Moon, did you meet any former smugglers?
I had two or three leads on older men in Gibson's, and I was about to interview them, and I lost them. They died by the time I got around to writing the book and had plotted it out and went to interview them. They were no longer available. So I did most of my research from Harbor Publishing books. For example, Howard White at Madeira Park has marvelous books, well-researched, and that's where I got my material.
So there were stories around, and there was some published material there,
yeah,
that you could draw on.
Lots.
Mary, you and I have talked before about Haida Gwaii, the Queen Charlotte Islands. Were you there before the logging?
Yes, I was, and it was a magical place. It would rain for a short period of time, and then the sun would come out, and there would be a rainbow, and the landscape, the scenery, the sky, and the ocean were changing all the time. Every 15 minutes, there was a different scene. But what I remember about Masset mostly is that I was given the choice to talk either on Vancouver Island or in Haida Gwaii as a speaker. I don't know who was sponsoring it. Oh, it was the library system, I think. And I chose Haida Gwaii because I'd never been there. So I got up to Masset, and they had it very nicely arranged in the public library for me. And I had brought two books, Snow Apples and The Secret Code of DNA, because I didn't know who was going to be in the audience. So we waited and we waited and we waited. And finally, two little boys turned up, age 5, and I knew they were not going to like snow apples. So I began to read The Secret Code of DNA, and within minutes they left. But otherwise it was a very successful trip, and I enjoyed it thoroughly.
I guess the people are too busy logging or fishing.
Well, I did have a hostess who was the wife of a fisherman, a commercial fisherman. Her name was Pat, and she took me all over the island, and so I had a personal tour from Masset to Queen Charlotte Island. It was a delightful day and stands out in my memory as probably the most enjoyable, although maybe not successful, reading tour I've ever done.
This is Elmer Weens hosting Smart People at CITR 101.9 FM Radio, Vancouver. Elmer Weens here interviewing Mary Rizel for the show Smart People. Let's talk about your new book, Dreaming of Horses. I really love the JPEG image of the cover you sent me.
Oh, me too. I think it's just terrific. The publishers were pleased. We had changed the title, you know, of that book. It was originally called Turkey Weed, but they thought that the connotation between marijuana and the country turkey was not a good one, so we changed it to Dreaming of Horses. I thought at first that it was a painting by an artist, and I was amazed the artist could capture the feeling of the book, the prairie wool, the foothills, the horses, and this young girl lying on the foothills dreaming of the horses. But in fact, it's a composite of two photographs. But anyway, it's marvelous. I think it will sell just based on the cover.
In Dreaming of Horses, Sheila Brary appears again as the novel's protagonist. In the novel, Snow Apples, Sheila was 16, living on the coast of BC with her mother and brothers. Does Dreaming of Horses fill in your readers with Sheila's life until she and her family leave Alberta?
Yes, it does. I first wrote it with the idea that it was going to be a memoir, which was rather presumptuous of me to think I was famous enough that anybody would care to read about my early days. I had a publisher in Edmonton who was interested in it, but finally not. So Dragon Hill Publishing in Edmonton are putting it out as adult fiction. It's one of those stories that fall in between. It's a story about a child. It's certainly not a YA novel. Teenagers wouldn't want to read about it. And I think the readership will be those people in Alberta who are interested in the early days of Alberta during the Depression. And I tried to keep the material accurate. My father had started the first trade union for mechanics in Alberta in 1933, so I went back and researched that to make sure those facts were correct. I have been working on that book for a number of years. It's been sitting in a cardboard box in my study. I've written numerous drafts. None of them worked. I was so pleased that Dragon Hill provided me with a very fine editor, Gary White, who helped me shape the story.
You agreed to read some of Dreaming of Horses, and that's what we'll have you do next.
Chapter 1. Lately I've started dreaming about horses again, great dark-haired horses with sleek coats, hot and moist, under my hand, and with breath live as yeast. The first time I dreamed about horses was the September when I was 7. That was in Calgary in 1937, the worst year of the Depression, historians now say. Neighbors murmured of wind and dust, and anxiety tightened the corners of their eyes. Kitty Corner from our house on the North Hill was a grocery store, and right next door to it a butcher shop. Behind them lay a courtyard of hard-packed earth with 5 horses, stables, clustered around it. 3 of the horses had been sold, and the remaining 2 were destined for the glue factory, or so said our next-door neighbor, Mrs. Bruce, who seemed to know everything going on in the neighborhood. Her husband was a bank manager downtown, and one of the few men on our street in those times who had a job. The 2 horses were lethargic and gaunt-hipped, but they would hang their heads over the stall doors and nicker whenever I entered the courtyard. I was fascinated by their stiff eyelashes and wide flaring nostrils, and I felt a tenderness towards them when their ears pricked up as I approached. The courtyard was the unofficial meeting place of the older neighborhood boys. My older brother Paul, who was 13, had ordered me to stay away. If it was just me, it would be okay, but it's the other guys. They don't want girls hanging around, especially kid sisters. But every morning after breakfast and before the neighborhood boys were out, I raced over to the courtyard to see if the horses were still there. Over the weeks that followed, I watched as their coats grew sparse and their eyes lost their luster. I began to dream about the horses, and I always had the same dream. I would lead the horses to the wide-open prairie that lay behind our house and let them go, my heart pounding to the rhythm of their hoofbeats as they wheeled away to the foothills, the floating shapes of the Rockies beyond. One late Saturday afternoon that September, Paul and his friends were scrounging around the neighborhood for old lumber for a bonfire. They soon hit a pile of broken fence pickets, bashed-in apple boxes, and tree branches that had come down during the last wind. All were carted to the vacant lot next to the grocery store, butcher shop, compound. I went over to watch. Billy Bruce, the biggest of the boys, called to me, "Sheila, run over to your house and get us a couple of matches." I squirmed and looked down. "My mother doesn't allow me to touch the matches," I said. "Where was Paul? I always felt safer when he was nearby." "But you know where they are, don't you?" Billy said. Now his frayed running shoes had planted themselves before me. "So get us a couple." His voice took on a coaxing quality. "Your mother wouldn't mind for something like this. Besides, if you get the matches, we'll roast a potato for you in our bonfire." "I'm not allowed to stay out after dark," I said, looking up at him for the first time, so I couldn't eat it anyway. "Paul can take it home to you," said Billy. I hesitated as the image of a black charred potato with steaming white flesh grew more and more vivid in my mind. Billy clamped a hand on my shoulder. "Come on," he said roughly, "don't be such a baby." "I'm not a baby. Why can't you get your own matches from your house?" "Because I need to be here to make everything sure that everything gets done. All I'm asking is for two matches." Then softly, "Tell you what, I'll get the other guys to let you come and visit the horses any time you want. You know those old nags aren't going to be around much longer. This may be your last chance." I looked over at the horses. They seemed to smile at me with their velvet lips. I ran home across a street that was suspended in the yellow glow of the setting sun. Quietly, I opened the back door. The kitchen and pantry were deserted. Sounds of my two younger brothers, Tom 5 and Andy, who was almost one, came from the living room. I heard the scrape of a chair and my mother's footsteps. Then the radio was turned on with a spate of static, and an organ began to play the theme music for the Lux Radio Theater. I knew that the wooden matches were stored in a jar on the top shelf of the pantry. I climbed up on the counter and reached for it. The lid was hard to unscrew, and the jar held only 6 matches. My fingers closed on 2 of them. I stared at their blue heads tipped with red. The matches felt alive in my trembling hand. As I began to move quietly towards the back door, my mother's voice called from the living room. "Is that you, Sheila?" I stopped, hand on the doorknob. "Yes, Mum." Something seemed stuck at the back of my throat. "What are you up to?" "Just getting a drink of water." I ran the tap and filled a tin drinking cup that sat on the wooden drain board, but I couldn't swallow and the water ran down my chin. Leaving the cup in the sink, I bolted out the back door to the vacant lot and Billy Bruce. The light was beginning to fade and the boys looked like black silhouettes against the dying sunset. Suddenly, Billy stood in front of me. He smelled musty, like earth and leaves and worms. Wordlessly, I handed over the 2 matches. I stayed long enough to see the fire catch, the flames dart up, blue and red, into the purple dusk. The sky looked heavy and sullen, and the air felt colder too, with a smell of snow in it. A strong wind gusted from the northeast and rattled the tree branches. I shivered. As I crossed the street back home, I heard the horses neigh from their stalls. I could feel their great dark eyes following me. By the time we got ready to go to bed that night, the wind had increased. "I wouldn't be at all surprised if we had a blizzard by dawn," my mother said. "I hope your father won't try and drive in this weather." Dad was due back from Edmonton, where he'd gone to look for a job. Worry lines webbed her forehead.
Thank you for that, Mary. When will your book Dreaming of Horses, be released.
It's at the printers right now. I'll be getting my free author copies in about 3 weeks, and I think it's coming out this fall.
And the publisher again is?
Dragon Hill Publishing in Edmonton, and they're under the umbrella, I believe that's how you say it, of Lone Tree Publishing.
And where can people buy your book?
Well, I believe that Hager Bookstore in Kerrisdale will be carrying it. That's usually where I get my books. If I want them, I just ask them to order it for me, and they're very good at that.
Your book was dedicated to your husband, Eric Nickel.
Well, Eric and I first met through my writing. I had entered a short story contest. It was called the Alumni Short Story Contest here at UBC, and Eric was one of the judges, and I was a student. There was an award dinner. I shared second prize. And the same day that I was to pick up my check and go to this lunch at the faculty club and meet Eric was the day that I was modeling a coat for my daughter who had just graduated from fashion merchandising. She'd made a very nice gray cashmere coat for the mature figure, and I was to be on stage at 1 o'clock at the Hyatt Regency downtown. But I was also supposed to pick up my check at the faculty club and have lunch at 12. So the only way I could do these two very important events was to take a cab. So they introduced me to Eric, and my first husband had left us, and I knew that Eric was a single parent. And so during just the beginning of the lunch, I said to myself, I hope this fellow will phone me. I mean, this is a very nice guy. So I said to him, here's my phone number. I'd really like to know what the other judges have to say about my story. Unfortunately, I was dressed for the stage with heavy stage makeup on because I had no time to lose, and I orange rouge, and I really looked like a tart. But he did phone me, and we did start going out together. And when I said to him later, it was lucky I gave you my phone number. And, you know, I was really looked like pretty cheap, and he said I didn't even notice.
Well, that's a very wonderful story of how you and Eric got together. You were saying that you also edited a book of his essays or short stories?
Yes, he died a couple of years ago at age 91, but he still kept writing right to the end, even though he was quite ill. And so I took them and edited them and gave them to his agent, Carolyn Swayze, and they were sold to Dundurn Publishing and came out a couple of years ago.
Oh, hey, what are your plans for your next book?
Well, I'm halfway through the first draft. I'm very excited about it. It's about friendships between girls. Again, it's a YA book. There's only one book I know that talks about friendships between girls or women, and that's by Elizabeth Hay. And it's a very subtle subject. So, as I say, I'm only halfway through my first draft, but I'm quite excited about it. And it is set, again, on the Sunshine Coast, and again, for teenage readers.
This is Elmer Weens. I've been talking to my friend Mary Rizel, whose book, Dreaming of Horses, will be released in the very near future. Thanks again, Mary. It was delightful having you chatting with me today.
CITR 101.9 FM Radio, Vancouver.